DW Deutsche Welle. Worldlink.
Hello and welcome to DW's Worldlink, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, Germany, I'm Neil King.
And I'm Marion Canute.
On this week's show, we hear about what scares a small island in the South China Sea even more than climate change.
We have to be vigilant because the salami tactics of China, they take one place at a time.
How a small-scale farmer is hit by the political clash between Turkey and Russia.
And about a Russian performance artist caught in the crosshairs of the Kremlin.
These stories and more coming up on Worldlink.
You're listening to DW's Worldlink, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, Germany, I'm Neil King.
And I'm Marion Canute.
One of the many issues highlighted at the 21st Conference of the Parties, or COP21, the climate change conference in Paris, has been the plight of small island states. They are among the most vulnerable to the effects of climate change, such as the projected rise in sea levels around the world. And some islands in the Pacific are already feeling the impacts.
But the mayor of one of the disputed Spratly Islands in the South China Sea is worried about more than just being underwater. His more immediate concern is of being under China. That is, he fears his tiny island, which now belongs to the Philippines, may be in real danger of being swallowed by an expansionist China. Michael Sullivan has more from the southern Philippines.
Mayor Eugenio Bito Onon is a lean and spry 59-year-old who decided to move to the tiny island of Pagasa, some 300 miles from anywhere, almost 20 years ago. He says it was love at first sight.
When I saw the place for the first time, I said it's perfect. And when you look underwater, wow, it's like an aquarium. It's lots of fish and nice corals. It's like a resort. I said I like it here. It was really very peaceful. Even the fishermen were friendly. And fishing boats from different countries like Vietnam, Hong Kong, they're just docked side by side. And they exchange a cigarette, exchange liqueur. And it's a friendly relationship between fishermen. You don't hear anything that say there's a commotion or a heightening conflict. There's no such thing.
Today, problem. Because of the simmering territorial dispute about the waters around his island, and the mayor is worried. Ed Knighty says it's easy to see the Chinese workers on nearby Subi Reef, not 10 miles away, completing their reclamation effort, filling in the reef, putting the finishing touches on the new military-grade airstrip they've constructed in the past year.
It's a small city, lots of lights, and you can see clearly the high-rise crane doing the construction there. During the day, you can see at the tip of the runway when the horizon is clear.
That construction has some on his island, not just worried, but fearful.
In the middle of the night, a certain wife called me up about this, you know, rumors of war and invasion. And she was crying and said, I want my husband to go back to the mainland. So I let the husband leave the island.
I'm speaking with the mayor at the harbor in Puerto Princesa on the island of Palawan. He's waiting to make the two-day-long, 300-mile journey back to his island, but he's got a busted ride.
Yes, our boat is supposed to go to Pagasa to bring provisions and materials for our project. But our starter got broken, so we need to find a replacement. We hope to find a replacement in 2 weeks' time.
Four times a year, the boat travels to the tiny island with provisions, rice, noodles, cooking oil, etc. Everything the roughly 120 residents depend on has to be brought by boat, or in emergencies by the military, which maintains a small garrison on the island. And in the past couple of years, he says, Chinese warships have been intimidating boats like his as China continues construction on its reclaimed reefs.
We have to be vigilant because the salami tactics of China, they take one place at a time. Now they have taken the Scarborough. Mischief Reef, they're doing an airport. So what comes next?
30 minutes.
We stop for a moment as a jet starts its final approach to land at Puerto Princesa Airport. Mayor Beto Anon's big worry is that China now has its eye on the resource-rich Reed Bank between his island and this one.
It's our submerged Saudi Arabia, actually. The Reed Bank has a reserve energy deposit that is almost bigger than Kuwait. So if China takes the whole of the South China Sea, it will never import gas for 105 years, more than a century, and oil for 5 years. So we should not lose that.
Those deposits beneath the waves may be one reason why the Chinese are aggressively pursuing their territorial claims based on a Chinese map with its so-called Nine Dash Line that claims almost all the South China Sea as theirs. Mayor Beto Anon is having none of it.
Not theirs. It's in our backyard.
But they claim they have a very big backyard.
They claim they have a very big backyard. It's based on the Nine Dash Line map. Now they keep on changing. It's 10 dash line, it's 11 dash line. It has no basis in international law. The Reed Bank is not theirs. The Scarborough is not theirs. It's not in their map. So we don't know where is the basis of the 9 dash line. If we lose the Reed Bank, we get zero. We really have to fight for that.
He hopes it doesn't come to that, that the international court rules in favor of the Philippines next year in its case against China and its territorial expansion. He says he hopes all the countries involved in the current dispute can work together and share the Spratlys to make them an ecotourism destination that will preserve the environment and its resources for everyone. For Deutsche Welle, I'm Michael Sullivan in Puerto Princesa, Palawan.
That was Michael Sullivan there, reporting from the Philippines.
Well, it always seems to be the little guys who get hit hardest by fallout from the battles between political titans, as is the case in our next story about a small-scale farmer in Turkey who's being crushed like a mosquito in the altercation between his government and Russia.
It all started when Ankara shot down a Russian fighter jet near the Syrian-Turkish border, saying that Russia, a major ally of the embattled Syrian regime, had encroached on its airspace.
In retaliation, the Kremlin last month decided to ban imports of Turkish agricultural products. The sanctions are due to take effect as of January 1st, to the delight of many citrus growers in Syria. They're seizing the chance to rush in and fill the gap as they reportedly prepare to ship more than 700,000 tons of citrus fruit to ready Russian markets.
But while the Russians and Syrian citrus producers chortle, small Turkish farmers are already feeling the effects of the planned sanctions. Natalie Carney reports from Antalya, Turkey.
So how many months old is this one?
After flower is blown up and it comes to tomato in 2 months.
Okay. Olcay Özturk helps run his family's tomato farm in the southern Turkish province of Antalya. The family's 38,000 square meter greenhouse produces upwards of 35 tons of tomatoes each week. In the summer months, that could double, even triple. Roughly 80% of their harvest goes to Russia.
The factor affecting the price the most is demand. This demand was reduced after Russia pulled out of the market. The supply now exceeds the demand, so we have to consume this supply in the domestic market. This has lowered the prices directly.
Olcay says the price for 1 kilo of tomatoes dropped by 33% in just 1 week after the sanctions were announced.
We have lost this season already. We believe we have lost it. Most possibly we will come out as a negative or at least break even, but we don't have big expectations.
According to the government, Turkey's agricultural exports to Russia amount to roughly 4% of Russia's total food imports. That's nearly $1.3 billion annually, says Turkey's agricultural minister Faruk Çelik.
The fresh vegetables and fruit affected by the sanctions amount to about $764 million.
Mr. Çelik says Turkey too could impose sanctions, but believes it's not an effective solution.
The agricultural products we import from Russia are more than $3 billion. The issue is about shooting down a jet. To take decisions against Russian and Turkish farmers doesn't benefit either side. It wasn't the Russian farmers who violated our border.
At a packaging and distribution warehouse in downtown Antalya, I met farmer Ahmet Çelik, who says he's not quite ready to give up on his biggest client, Russia, just yet.
A different customer? No, we're hoping the politicians will improve their relations so the farmers will not suffer from this. Already prices have dropped. We used to bring in 10 to 15 tons here a day, but now it's only 5 to 6 tons.
While the sanctions go into effect January 1st, Russia has already started to place stricter controls on Turkish products entering the country, causing some Turkish farmers to complain about rotting produce as their trucks sit idle at the Russian border. So Olcay and others like him are thinking of creative ways to get around the ban.
When the embargo starts on the 1st of January, exporters will try to sell their produce to Russia in unlabeled boxes through markets such as Poland or Azerbaijan.
In the meantime, Turkish farmers are eagerly searching for new markets and hoping to make the most out of the domestic demand.
For the short-term solution, we are attempting to reduce our costs. We usually use a heating system and we're burning coal. Now we have reduced the heating and slowed down the production. For the next season, we will have to develop new production techniques. We can change the types of tomatoes. We can turn towards products that don't need heating and big labor. But I really don't know what the producer will do in the domestic market. In April, May and June, the supply will increase as the temperature increases. Then we think the prices will really tank unless the crisis is over.
Back at the warehouse, boxes packed with fresh fruits and vegetables sit in crates ready to be shipped out.
Of course we're worried.
Farmer Mehmet echoes Olcay's concerns.
We've planted our second crop, but we don't know what to do with it. There will be more production, especially as it will be summer. Our problem will be where to send it, what to do with it.
It could take months, years to develop a new alternative market, he says. At the giant greenhouse, Olcay peels a delicious-looking, juicy orange tomato off a vine of thousands and takes a big bite. Despite the risk of losing 80% of his annual income from the lost Russian market, Olcay appears to be awfully calm. He says the Turkish government is likely to help them stay afloat.
The government is really supporting this sector. Instead of distributing money for no reason, they finance for the solution of the problem. This affects us positively. Regarding this crisis, we have heard that there will be some kind of financial support. It could be in the form of low-interest loans, or they could postpone the farmers' repayments of previous loans.
Russia's ban on Turkish agriculture includes 15 different types of fruits and vegetables, most of which are not grown in that country. Russia's Minister of Economic Development says Russia will need time to substitute these banned goods. So while Turkish producers search for alternative measures, Russian consumers will be searching for alternative suppliers. Natalie Carney for DW in Antalya, Turkey.
While Russia continues to invoke Turkey's wrath, it's finding itself in turbulent waters on other fronts as well. After the annexation of the Ukrainian peninsula Crimea, Russia became a pariah for the West. It was excluded from the G8 and was at the receiving end of sanctions. But with Europe focusing on Syria, the refugee crisis, and the battle against the Islamic State, Russia seems once more to have become an ally of sorts, even if the sanctions have once more been prolonged. However, the Kremlin isn't just wary of its international critics. It is clamping down hard on its internal dissenters as well, often using the Russian legal system as an instrument of repression.
Russian performance artist Pyotr Pavlensky has been in pretrial detention in Russia since November 9th because of his most recent performance. He set fire to a door of Russia's Secret Service headquarters, the FSB, to protest against the organization which he says is a source of terrorism against the Russian people. Earlier this month, his detention was extended, preventing him from opening his first international retrospective exhibition in the northern German city of Hamburg. Instead, his partner and co-artist, Oksana Shaligina, along with his lawyer, attended. Our reporter, Marijke Aden, caught up with them just before the exhibition opened.
Stools and benches are moved around in the atrium of a cultural center and exhibition space in the north of Hamburg. Those are last-minute preparations for the discussion that is about to take place here.
This is a chance for me to speak out, to talk about how the situation in Russia really is. Actually, it's quite difficult and repressive. People feel low and are afraid to speak out or do anything. They're scared of the security service, the FSB. It's the main source of danger. And now Pyotr targeted the FSB directly with his most recent performance. So it remains to be seen how strongly they'll lash back. For me, being here is a chance to speak on Pyotr's behalf.
Oksana Shaligina has a slim, almost boyish figure and wears her blonde hair short. The hard expression in her face softens after a while. She seems like a person who's always on her guard. She's been together with Pyotr for years. They have two daughters, but she doesn't want to be called his wife or his girlfriend. They're not married, out of protest against the Russian state, she says. She prefers the word partner or combatant. Several screens are suspended from this ceiling. They show performances of Pavlensky in a loop, also the one he's now charged for with vandalism. He set the door of the FSB headquarters in Moscow on fire, the same site where the KGB had resided during the Soviet era, questioning and torturing countless people.
Yes, it's very likely indeed that he'll be jailed. But I see that all as part of our work in the sphere of political art. From the beginning, we were determined to go to the end. And when I say the end, I mean the end in a physical way, literally. We risk everything.
Pyotr Pavlensky, born in 1984, became famous, or depending who you talk to in Russia, infamous in the summer of 2012. Until then, he was an artist studying at a prestigious art institute in St. Petersburg with no particular focus on performance art. It was the summer after Vladimir Putin's return to the presidency. The winter, with its mass protests against the authorities in Moscow, was followed by a crackdown on the opposition. There were several show trials, one against the women of Pussy Riot, who were tried and convicted for hooliganism after their controversial art performance in Russia's most important Orthodox church. Oksana Shaligina says that they were waiting for a sign of solidarity from the Russian art scene, but when everybody kept silent, Pavlensky decided it was time for him to act.
At first, he just wanted to stage a one-person protest with a sign in his hand in front of a church building in St. Petersburg. But then he decided he didn't want to react and to give in to the authorities. He didn't want to talk to the police who would arrive and didn't want to show his documents on request. So he stitched together his lips with the aim of not being forced into a dialogue with those in power.
So Stitch is what he called his first performance, and on the screen in the Hamburg Gallery you see a video of him standing there holding up a sign. Gaunt with those thin dark stitches visible on his lips. A police officer is trying to drag his protest sign away from him while he is holding on. He returned to the motive of self-harm in other performances. In one he has cut off his earlobe, and in another he nailed his scrotum to the cobblestones of Red Square. Another time he wrapped himself in a cocoon of barbed wire until police started to cut the barbed wire away. Russian state media, which occasionally have reported about the performances, call Pavlensky a masochist and question his mental health. During investigations against him, Pavlensky underwent several psychiatric analyses where he was always declared sane. And Oksana Shaligina says it's not about personal pain at all.
He shows in his performances how every human being is trapped in the prison of daily life. In fact, every one of us, every moment is inside this cocoon of barbed wire. And he's using artistic means to show that we feel pain with every move we make, even if it's not as tangible as in Pyotr's performance. People feel trapped, and so they don't move. That's a fact.
Oksana says Pyotr Pavlensky wants to give hope to people by creating symbols and strong pictures that people won't forget. That's why he works closely with the remaining independent media in Russia. Of every performance, there is a video. Pavlensky is already on trial for vandalism in a separate case. In February 2014, he erected barricades made of tires on a bridge in St. Petersburg and set them on fire. It was an imitation of the anti-government protests in Ukraine. His lawyer, Dmitry Dinze, says that Pavlensky is doing fine in prison and that his pre-trial detention and the court hearings are part of his performance.
Pyotr wants to include those in power in his performances. The authorities never know what to do with him. When he was sitting in the Red Square, nailed to the ground, naked, they threw a white sheet over him eventually. Another time they cut him free from barbed wire. He forces the people who belong to the system to play an active role in his performance.
The trial won't start before February, says the lawyer, who's also from St. Petersburg and has been working with Pyotr Pavlensky for some years now. Dmitry Dinze thinks that the authorities made a mistake by detaining Pavlensky and making him stand trial.
Pavlensky always says, I don't care what happens to me and how many years I get. He's a guy who says he has nothing to lose, who's prepared to sit in prison and to suffer, who will always do it his way. And when a person has nothing to lose, what do you do with him?
From Hamburg, that was Marijke Aden reporting, bringing us to the end of the first half of our program. You're listening to DW's World Link with me, Marion Canute.
And me, Neil King.
You're listening to DW's World Link, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. I'm Marion Canute.
And I'm Neil King.
Today we hear from an unlikely doctor duo harmonizing their healing in the Middle East.
And we look at how mobile clinics are rolling to the rescue of cash-strapped patients in the US.
Somebody will get out of a dental chair, they've been in pain for weeks or months and sometimes years, and they'll hug the doctor, the dentist, the assistant. A little kid will try on a pair of glasses for the first time and just be absolutely amazed that he can see the leaves on the trees.
But first, a look at a hardline right-wing star on France's political horizon, whose rise is being closely watched by worried governments across Europe.
It was perhaps to be expected that France's right-wing Front National, or FN party, headed by Marine Le Pen, would gain political traction after the Paris terrorist attacks. But the country's traditional parties still reeled in shock when the FN recently won big in the first round of regional elections, bagging a third of the vote.
One of the right-wing stars of those FN victories was a lesser-known member of the Le Pen family who has risen to capture the lead in the wealthy and influential Provence-Alpes-Côte d'Azur region in the south, Marion Maréchal Le Pen. She's young, photogenic, and as an ultra-Catholic, is even more hardline than her aunt Marine or her grandfather, party founder Jean-Marie Le Pen.
As she gains popularity with a broad spectrum of French voters, she's also seen as more dangerous than her two more famous relatives. Here's John Lawrenson with a profile of Marion Maréchal Le Pen.
Ce soir, le vieux monde des politiciens est mort.
Tonight, the old world of politicians is dead, their morality lessons too. They have not been able to camouflage their failures and their capitulations. Today, it's the Republic that has given them a lesson.
Marion Maréchal Le Pen speaking after the polling booths closed, after the first round of voting in this month's regional elections, which put her a clear, very blonde-haired head above her conservative and socialist rivals in the prosperous up-and-coming region of Provence-Alpes-Côte d'Azur. Ludovic, a young inhabitant of Nice, voted for Marion, as he calls her. He says the recent terror attacks in Paris weighed on his choice.
It's true, I think the attacks were a catalyzer for many people. But already there was a lot of sympathy there because people have been disappointed by other leaders. They see that Nicolas Sarkozy and François Hollande did not bring the change they promised.
In the past, the National Front supporters have tended to be elderly, but in these elections, more 18 to 25-year-olds voted National Front than for anyone else, due in part to the replacement of the octogenarian Jean-Marie Le Pen by his daughter Marine, but even more so by the sudden rise of Jean-Marie's granddaughter and Marine's niece, Marion. Marion Maréchal Le Pen started life late, compared to most of us, after even the fall of the Berlin Wall. But in politics, she started early, appearing in a campaign poster of her grandfather Jean-Marie Le Pen at the age of two. At 22, she became the youngest ever French parliamentarian when she became what she still is, one of the only two National Front members in the National Assembly. But that youth has also had its drawbacks.
Oula, il y en a beaucoup.
When she was 20, she campaigned in the western suburbs of Paris in the last regional elections. And in a YouTube video that suddenly went viral during these elections, we see her make an almighty hash of a television interview. The journalist doesn't go in hard at all, just asks what, concretely, the National Front is proposing to improve the morale of people in this region. The best she can do is laugh, apologise for not having all the facts and figures in her head before appealing for help to her assistant, bursting into tears and retreating out of shot, leaving her assistant to cover for her as best she can. But if Marion Maréchal Le Pen was a lightweight when she was 20, she's not anymore. In fact, she tends to speak too fast, shooting out her bullet points as if consciously trying to bury the deleterious effect of that embarrassing YouTube video beneath the barrister's fluency she learned at Assas, the Paris law faculty that once had a reputation for producing ultra-right-wing firebrands. And the slightly too cool for school youth speak of her first interventions in Parliament have given way to performances which are confident, well-argued and sometimes fiery, like this one directed at her worst enemy in the National Assembly, the Prime Minister Manuel Valls.
Gardez donc votre mépris crétin et vos leçons de république.
You can keep your cretinous disdain and your lessons about republican values for your own party, she said, before listing a string of Socialist Party politicians who have been exposed for corruption since François Hollande became president.
Et tant d'autres qui ont volé les Français.
Marion Maréchal Le Pen is therefore a powerful speaker who is especially formidable in the heat and rapidity of a live radio or TV debate, much like her aunt and her grandfather. But there is something that marks her out from these first two members of the Le Pen dynasty, her Catholicism. Jean-Marie only mentions his faith in order to crack jokes about it. Marine sometimes wears a cross around her neck, but was responsible for ending her party's traditional opposition to abortion, lives out of wedlock with the National Front's vice president Florian Philippot, and has taken to announcing secularism as a fourth principle of the French Republic, alongside liberty, equality and fraternity. Marion was brought up by her stepfather and only met her natural father, a journalist and diplomat, when she was 13. Later, her mother and stepfather divorced, and it was Auntie Marine who stepped in to help look after her. Perhaps part reaction to this disorderly family background, but also the fruit of her traditionalist Catholic schooling, Catholicism is very much part of who Marion Maréchal Le Pen is. She goes to church, takes part in the spring pilgrimages from Paris to Chartres, argues for recognition of France's Christian roots, and while Marine Le Pen took a cautious line in the great French gay marriage debate, Marion was and is a passionate opponent of same-sex marriage, surrogate motherhood, and medically assisted procreation for gay couples. And for some, this is her weak point. A couple of weeks ago, Marion Maréchal Le Pen vowed to stop regional funding for family planning clinics, which she said were political organisations that promote abortion and gay marriage. It was possibly the least popular policy statement of the National Front's regional election campaign. John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
Now in another part of the world where there's an explosive mix of politics, religion and violence, we see how it's possible to put conflict on hold to make room for bridge building and healing as we travel to the Middle East.
There we meet two doctors from different sides of the political, religious and cultural divide in the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. But these doctors have joined forces to become a potent healing team at Israel's Hadassah University Hospital in Jerusalem.
The very city in which the hospital operates is, on many levels, at the center of the conflict. But the hospital doesn't differentiate between victims of the violence. And every day, Dr. Eid and Dr. Fried and their teams live their passion to help those in need, and they're doing it together. Federica Sasso sends us this story from Jerusalem.
My name is Ahmed. You see, already I show my Israeli origin, because in Arabic, Ahmed, this is the name. But my Jewish friend, they call me Ahmed. So I say Ahmed. Ahmed Eid.
My name is Elchanan Fried. And my name is also in Hebrew, it's Elchanan Fried, but it has also an Arabic meaning, Elchanan. It's like a love of a parent to a child. And Farid is a very common Palestinian Arabic name. Yeah, Arabic name.
I call him Dr. Farid.
Ahmed Eid is the head of general surgery, and Elchanan Fried leads the intensive care unit at Hadassah University Hospital in Mount Scopus, here in Jerusalem. Eid is Muslim, Fried is Jewish, but they point out right away that there is no black and white here, in their names or the reality they live and work in.
I know Professor Eid since I was a student. He's one of my role models. My father even knew him. My father is also a physician. And when I came to study medicine, he told me that he knew Professor Eid when he was a resident. I started here 5 years ago. And since then, we are working as colleagues. And really, I cannot see a better way to work together than the way we actually do it.
Their collaboration is just an example of daily life at Hadassah, where Arab and Jewish staff work side by side.
Patients is around 50-50. And also, again, we are a mixed staff. For us, it's something very common and natural, and we don't even think about it.
During periods of violence like the one Israel and Palestine have been experiencing recently, Hadassah becomes a central place. All the victims and asylums involved in the attacks around Jerusalem are taken to the two hospitals, in Mount Scopus and in Karem. Doctors and nurses take care of everyone, no questions asked. And this creates a very unique environment in times when suspicion and fear are spiking among the people of this city. Dr. Fried points out that this has been Hadassah's call since the beginning, when it was founded in 1934.
It's one of the first modern hospitals in the Mediterranean, and since it was built, its purpose was to serve the community around here, which is completely mixed, and that's one of the, I think, the most important things that we represent. We're continuing this long-standing mission, and hopefully we'll continue on doing it, regardless of the last regretful events that are happening here. Our population, again, is mixed on a regular basis with no relations to whatever happens around. These times bring it like in a stronger context because of we can see like victim and a perpetrator coming together. So it's something bizarre or unique or special. But for us, a patient is a patient, and this is what we do.
On a regular day, the hospital is quiet and everything carries on smoothly. Veiled women are rocking their children in the pediatric unit. Muslim and Orthodox families visit their elderly, who rest in beds next to each other. Today, Eid and Fried are talking about a patient who underwent a pancreas operation.
We just have now a really very difficult patient after a very big surgical procedure called the Whipple operation. It's an operation to take out the pancreas. So I am a little bit concerned about this, and I was going to talk with him what he thinks about this issue. And sometimes you fight here and there, you know.
But it's okay. It's like it always brings the best of us. We have disagreements, but always, eventually, we come to one decision for the best of the patient.
Hadassah is a special place because Jerusalem is the core of the ongoing conflict in this land. But Fried points out that all around Israel, most hospitals are hubs of coexistence.
Like in Soroka, they have all the Bedouin population there. In Tzfat or Poria, they have now even Syrian patients coming in. So hospitals in Israel do treat mixed population on a regular basis.
Hello.
The wave of attacks in Jerusalem has been slowing down, but not stopped. Eid explains how the hospital is able to absorb the shock provoked by terrorism or big incidents.
I'd say, really, it's continuing the same way. Of course, there is disruption of the, you know, routine work, because if some victim coming to the emergency room, we have to check in him to make sure, maybe to operate him, so we have to stop all the operations. So it has some collateral effect, but the hospital is functioning very well as the same.
And he adds that life here really goes on.
Life is going on. People in other countries in Europe, they say, oh, how they live? Everything stop all the time fighting. No, everything is okay.
That report comes to us from Federica Sasso in Jerusalem.
And while the two doctors optimize their collaboration to provide care for their patients in Jerusalem, for many people in the United States, seeing a doctor is simply out of the question due to a lack of money.
The Affordable Care Act, more often known as Obamacare, sought to change that. And since it's come into effect 2 years ago, the number of insured Americans has risen dramatically.
But 1 in 10 Americans still do not have any kind of health insurance. That's around 40 million people. And for them, mobile clinics offering free services are a lifeline. Reporter Loveday Wright went to Lee County in Virginia to find out more.
At this mobile health clinic in rural Virginia, hundreds of people are waiting to see the dentist or doctor, many of them for the first time in years. Some have been waiting nearly 24 hours, camping out in their cars overnight in order to be among the first in line. They're here because it's free. In the US, if you can't afford health insurance, getting medical treatment is a problem.
An incident where he has no insurance, he cut his finger, about cut it off, went to the emergency room. They had to call three doctors before one would sew his finger up because he didn't have insurance. That's how bad it is.
That's Judy Stapleton. She's here with her husband, Aaron, who recently retired. He lost his health insurance when he stopped working. Now his pension isn't enough to cover it.
The thing about it is, if I don't have insurance to pay and go into the emergency room or have to go into the hospital, they could wind up with everything I have and all, everything I've worked for. It's gone.
Aaron and Judy used to be fairly well off. Before the coal mines in the area were closed, they had good jobs.
It's hard, you know, when you were used to a good income and health insurance and you're brought down now to nothing. I can't afford it.
Aaron now relies on free clinics like this one, run by volunteers. Judy has health insurance through her job, for now. She's approaching 60 and is worried about the future.
At this point in our lives, my parents were comfortable. We struggle. We struggle from 1 week or 1 month to the next. And it's depressing because we've worked all our lives, and it's just depressing.
66, 67, 68.
The clinic is taking place in a tiny private airport in Lee County, one of the poorest regions in Virginia. At 3 a.m., numbered tickets were handed out. Treatment is first come, first served. And just before 6, people begin to emerge from their cars into the dark, wet morning.
76. 77.
It's around 9 a.m. by the time Aaron and Judy are called through. Everyone gets a medical checkup. Then patients have to choose between seeing the dentist and the eye doctor. It's those areas the clinic focuses on, because even if you can afford insurance, basic coverage rarely includes dental and eye care.
I think a lot of people who are having trouble paying bills find that dentistry is probably one of the first things that gets cut from their thought process.
Gregory Colwell is among the dozens of volunteer dentists in pastel-coloured scrubs, each of them wedged in next to one of the 20 dentist's chairs. Numerous student volunteers flip back and forth with trays of equipment and buckets of water. Dental treatment is the top priority for many of the 500 patients who visit over the weekend.
The main issues I've seen are just, you know, lack of regular dental care more than anything.
The 47-year-old has travelled nearly 900 miles from his home in Boston, Massachusetts, to help out. It's his first time at an event like this.
I just saw a 22-year-old kid who's going to have all his remaining upper teeth removed and get a denture. And it's something where I practice that I don't even see at 72.
Behind the 162 volunteers here is Stan Brock. Stan is the founder of Remote Area Medical, or RAM, an organization which travels around the U.S. setting up mobile healthcare clinics. Stan is 80 years old. He exercises for 2 hours a day and flew into the clinic himself in his own tiny plane.
If you're here to see the dentist, please raise your hand.
He's sprightly, in a military-style uniform, greeting the patients and ensuring everything is running smoothly. Originally from Britain, Stan started the organization whilst living in the Amazon, where the closest doctor was 26 days away, on foot. But when he arrived in the US, he saw that many people simply could not afford healthcare.
The people that we see at events like this, and we've seen hundreds of thousands of people during the 30 years that I have been doing this with Remote Area Medical, there is no safety net for these people.
Today is the 770th clinic, and volunteer doctors and dentists keep returning.
Somebody will get out of a dental chair, they've been in pain for weeks or months and sometimes years, and they'll hug the doctor, the dentist, the assistant. A little kid will try on a pair of glasses for the first time and just be absolutely amazed that he can see the leaves on the trees. And so this is a great inspiration to the 90-odd thousand volunteers to get that kind of appreciation from the people that they help.
One of those patients is Lum Abnadiri. The 24-year-old was one of the first in the dentist chair, having waited all day and all night in his car. Abner does odd jobs as a handyman, but is currently unemployed, like almost 60% of the population here in Lee County. When he came to the clinic, his two front teeth were visibly rotten. Now they're a shiny white.
I had my front teeth filled, and afterwards they told me I needed to have them cleaned, so I went and got them cleaned, and I feel fabulous. I feel fabulous. Well, it's a lot better. It gives me my confidence back because I ain't got holes in my teeth and my teeth ain't split open. So, yeah, I feel a lot better than what I did when I first come in here.
Over 2 days in Lee County, RAM provides medical care to the poor to a value of around $229,000. Although the organization has some big name sponsors, it's primarily funded by small private donations. For the millions of Americans too poor to afford healthcare, it's a lifeline. But for patients like Aaron Stapleton, the need for sick citizens to turn to charity is a symptom of bigger problems.
You know, we may have to pinch pennies, so to speak, but still yet we'll get by. But for America, she's in trouble. She's already in trouble.
Loveday Wright, DW, Lee County, Virginia.
Loveday Wright with that story from the U.S. state of Virginia. And as we always enjoy ending the program on a musical note, we now look at a rather interesting fusion, China meets Western disco from bygone days.
Dancer and choreographer Ah Gao is one of the bright stars of contemporary dance in mainland China. A native of Canton, China's third largest city, he began dancing when he was 14. The same year, he started exploring his homosexuality, and his works often focus on the themes of identity and gender.
Born in 1985, Ah Gao has for a long time been fascinated by the brief window of fun and freedom that the advent of disco from the West brought to China around the time he was born. Over the past year, he's been involved in a cultural project that looks at its impact and legacy. His resulting solo performance, Discoteca, recently had its world premiere at this year's Genderbender Festival in Italy. Danny Mitzman was there and sends us this story from Bologna.
Last night a DJ saved my life with a song.
其实一直以来我在
I've always been interested in disco and especially the reaction it causes in people. Even though I have not experienced the age of disco myself, because it was when I was very little, I've always been very interested in how somehow our body remembers it or somehow connects to it. So when we hear that kind of music, we somehow let go and we move in a different way than any other kind of music.
When I turned on my radio, I found out all I needed to know.
Ah Gao began his training in traditional Chinese dance before winning a scholarship to study modern and contemporary dance in Hong Kong.
As contemporary Chinese people, the way we use and we allow ourselves to use our body is still very restricted. There is no space for improvisation or freestyling. We somehow execute it as precisely as we can. There are a lot of taboo areas around the pelvis, so that if you shake or if you wave in a certain way, it's still somehow perceived as obscene or not decent. And it's something that comes from way back, but we are still influenced by it. While in disco, somehow all of these limits, all of these restrictions break.
His one-man show, Discoteca, sees Ah Gao donning an elongated disco ball hat. It sends glistening lights across the stage and ceiling, giving the audience the sensation of a 70s-80s nightclub dance floor. Using video projections of 80s disco performances, the show captures a brief moment in Chinese history when repression gave way to physical but also cultural liberation.
The mid to late 80s in China was a period of great openness. So people started to express themselves through clothing, through music, through drinking coffee, which was a very exotic thing to do. It all happened in those years.
But that openness was to come to an abrupt end with the events of Tiananmen Square in 1989. Hundreds of protesting students were killed by the military in what came to be known as the June the 4th massacre. The window of free self-expression slammed shut, and Chinese dance returned to being more stylized and controlled. Nevertheless, the seeds sown by his parents' generation left their legacy in Argao and his peers.
We were trained in traditional Chinese dance, so a lot of attention was paid to make each and every movement as gracious and elegant as possible. And then by the time I was a teenager, me and a group of other kids, we started going secretly to the disco. And then it was a huge breakthrough because you see all kinds of people dancing and they're somehow dancing not following the traditional way or not trying so hard to look elegant. And then also with other classmates, we would go in some classroom and play some music, turn off the lights and dance all together.
With Discoteca, Argao seeks to describe how Western disco music managed to penetrate Chinese culture.
What did you think?
It's a show that I found bizarre, but probably because I didn't understand all the elements that are in the show. And there are a lot of elements, something very familiar and something very unknown or exotic or very far away from our aesthetic.
Probably it was difficult for me to understand completely the show, but you know, when he was alone in the scene with light and the mirror ball in his head, there was a kind of magic, a different magic of the other Italian or European shows.
While disco came in via Hong Kong, as a young man, Argao came out via the same route. Having returned to live in his hometown of Guangzhou, Argao now feels comfortable expressing himself both personally and artistically in modern mainland China. And even if he says acceptance is widespread today, the Discoteca project has given him the chance to explore a time in China when all those ideas were only just starting to be unwrapped. Danny Mitzman for DW in Bologna.
And that was Danny Mitzman bringing us to a very danceable end of today's programme.
World Link was produced by Neil King and Marion Canute, and our sound engineer was Michael Springer. If you'd like to listen to the show or any of the reports again, please visit our website at dw.com/worldlink. World Link is brought to you by DW in Bonn, Germany.